This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents StarCraft Evolution by Timothy Zahn. Read for you by Christopher Ryan Grant. Chapter 1. The war was over. The nightmares weren't. Marine Sergeant Foster Wist Cray didn't mind the dreams so much. Hell, he'd survived 5 straight years of living nightmares while he was deployed. He ought to be used to fear and panic by now. What got him about the damn things was the monotony. The war had been hell on wheels, but at least it had offered occasional changes of scenery. His platoon had been deployed to desert, jungle, forest, grassland, city. They weren't so much cities as they were heaps of shattered masonry and twisted pipe by the time his platoon got there. But it still counted. And once, even on a beach. The enemy had been pretty diverse, too. He'd blasted away at Zerglings, Hydralisks, Ravagers, and all the rest of the umpty-ump hell-spawned varieties of Zerg. Sometimes the Overlord or Queen, or whoever was running that particular assault, sent in the nastier monsters, at which point the Marines would grab some dirt while a Viking or a Thor waded in to deal with them. But even new enemies meant something different to look at. He'd seen a few Protoss, too, usually on the far side of the battlefield where they weren't doing the Dominion forces a whole lot of good. Once or twice, he'd even ended up taking a pot shot at one of them, when the big alien had been careless enough to get in the way. But the nightmares were all annoyingly the same. It was always Zerglings and Hydralisks. It was always him and Jesse and Lena standing shoulder to shoulder against the onslaught. And his damn C-14 Gauss rifle never worked. It fired just fine. It barked out the usual thud and mule-kicked against his combat suit shoulder just like it was supposed to. But instead of the 8mm spikes blazing toward the charging monsters at hypersonic speeds, they just blooped out in a pathetic little arc that nosedived them into the dirt a couple of meters in front of him. He would fire again and again, not accomplishing a damn thing, except to make a collection of spikes in the ground. The Zerg kept coming, and they were just opening their jaws for lunch when he woke up in a cold sweat. He never knew what happened to Jesse and Lena. He often wondered if they survived the dream. Probably not. They hadn't survived the war. No reason they should survive the dream either. Afterward, he usually just lay alone in the dark, listening to his heart thudding as he waited to fall asleep again. Sometimes he slipped out of his room in the Marines' new barracks in Augustgrad and took a cup of coffee up to the roof to clear his head in the cold night air. But today was special. Today was the 6th anniversary of the end of the war, or at least his part of it. Today the nightmare and the reminder of the sacrifices of Jesse and Lena and all the others called for something more. Usually the roof was deserted because sane people who weren't on night duty were in bed at this hour. Tonight, though, someone else was already topside when Wist arrived. The man was short and thin and hunched over a little, leaning his elbows on the low parapet and gazing toward the outskirts of the city. "About time," he called, as Wist stepped out of the stairway. Hastily, Wist lowered the bottle he'd liberated from the non-commissioned officer's club, hiding it behind his leg. Hard liquor wasn't supposed to be consumed outside the club's controlled environment. "Excuse me," he called back. The other man half turned, and in the reflected light from the central part of the city behind him, Wist could see the all-too-familiar fusion of physical youth and crushing psychological age. A war vet, for sure. "Sorry," the kid said. "I thought you were someone else." He beckoned. "Come on, join the crowd. I see you brought the refreshments." Wist wrinkled his nose. So much for keeping the bottle hidden. For a second, he thought about turning around and making a run for it before he could be identified. Then, decided he really didn't give a damn. "You've got a whacked idea of good places to meet people," he commented, starting across the uneven roofing material. "I'm here for the view, not the ambiance," the other said, gesturing over the edge of the roof behind him. "A buddy and I were going to watch a night training session. He must have slept through his alarm." Wist frowned past his shoulder. In the distance, above one of the collections of rubble that had once been a suburb, he could see 10 muted glows buzzing around like unhappy hornets.
"What are those?"
"What do you think?" the kid countered with a snort. "Who else except Reapers gets dragged out for training in the middle of the night these days?"
"I thought Reapers mostly just kangarooed over hills and off cliffs," Wist said. "When did they start zooming around in circles?"
"Oh, they used to do that all the time," the kid said. "When the Reaper program started, they were given fully flight-capable jetpacks."
"Sounds like fun."
"I'm sure it was," the kid said. "Trouble was, the new recruits also had a tendency to crash. A lot."
"I heard the packs used to explode, too."
"More often than anyone liked," the kid conceded. "Anyway, after the war ended and they suddenly had enough time for proper training, they started phasing in the old equipment design, keeping some of the standard units the same while putting others in the new, improved packs and taking them back to the original mission statement."
"Minus the random explosions?"
"So we hope, yes."
"Well, floating around certainly makes them better targets," Wist commented, choosing his words carefully.
"We," the kid had said. So he was a Reaper too? Terrific. Because if Marines were the best of the best, Reapers were the worst of the worst. Literally. Or at least they used to be. During the war, under the reign of Emperor Arcturus Minsk, the whole Corps had supposedly been made up of hardened criminals whose antisocial tendencies couldn't be brain-panned away and who had opted for crazy-ass military duty as an alternative to prison, or worse. Marines might like the way Reapers could swoop down out of nowhere onto a Zerg attack front, but no one really trusted them. The new Emperor, Arcturus's son, Valerian, was purportedly changing all that. Personally, Wist would believe it when he saw it.
"Spoken like someone who's been one of those targets,"
the kid offered his hand.
"Lieutenant Dennis Halkman, 122nd Reapers."
"Yes, sir," Wist said, stiffening to attention and throwing a salute. A Reaper and an officer? This just got better and better.
And if Halkman had been in the 122nd, he'd almost certainly been in the war. Possibly for years, which made him a definite anomaly. Typical service lifetime for a Reaper was 6 months.
"Sergeant Foster Cray, 934th Marines," Wist continued, identifying himself.
"Nice to meet you, Sergeant," the kid said,
making no effort to lower his hand or return the salute.
"And I should have mentioned that's former Lieutenant. I've been rotated into the reserves, and you probably hate officers anyway, so let's skip the sirs and saluting, okay? And call me Diz."
"Yes, sir," Wist said, frowning. Definitely not the kind of officer interaction he was used to. Of course, Diz would have an entire pre-Reaper criminal skill set tucked away. Maybe this folksy, aw shucks approach to new people was something he'd developed to put them at their ease. Maybe he'd been a con man?
"And you can call me Wist," he added, taking Diz's hand and shaking it. Diz had a good, strong grip, the kind that dripped confidence and trustworthiness. Definitely would fit a con man persona. Then again, it would fit a lot of other criminal types too, up to and including serial murderers. Did the Reapers accept serial murderers?
"Much better," Diz said approvingly, a frown creasing his forehead. He was probably wondering if Wist was speculating about his past sins, a conversation Wist had no intention of getting into, certainly not on a deserted rooftop when he wasn't even wearing his sidearm.
So, okay. The minute Diz started steering the conversation that direction, Whist would make an excuse and head back to his quarters.
The 934th, you say?
Diz continued.
Were you the unit sent to clean the Zerg out of the Northwoods Forest on New Sydney?
Whist blinked, disengaging his brain from his mental gymnastics. The Northwoods Forest.
We were there. Yeah, he confirmed. You were the Reaper unit, right?
Oh yeah, that was us, Diz said, grinning suddenly. So, I'm guessing you had a front row seat when Boff brushed one of the trees, bounced sideways, and nearly cannonballed into one of your guys,
Whist snorted.
Front row seat, hell, he said. There were few enough reasons to smile in battle, but that incident had been one such rare gem. I was maybe 3 Marines to his left when your boy started his pinwheel act. For a second, I thought he was coming straight at me.
The way he was flying, probably everyone in the unit thought that, Diz said. I remember being impressed as hell that none of you hit the dirt, or even flinched.
Trust me, we were flinching inside, Whist said. Just wasn't time to actually do anything.
Except swear, Diz said. That Marine he tried to flatten, what was his name again?
Grounder.
Right. I think Grounder swore for 3 minutes straight without ever repeating himself.
I don't doubt it, Whist said. I was too busy with a pair of Zerglings right after that to pay much attention, but if you wanted an applied history of Terran vulgar language, Grounder was your man. Never knew anyone with that depth of vocabulary.
Well, he sure impressed us, Diz said. Though probably less about the language than about the fact he kept Boff speechless that long.
I think he got in a sorry mate once when Grounder stopped for breath, Whist offered. But that was about it.
Made for an interesting day, all right, Diz said. That, plus the fact we won.
Whist hissed between his teeth, the brief glow of humor from that day fading away into the rest of the bad memories.
Yes, they'd won, but at a hell of a cost. Yeah, he said. What happened to Boff? Did he make it?
He made it through that particular battle, anyway, Diz said. He was transferred right afterward, and I never heard what happened to him. How about Grounder?
He lasted 3 more battles, Whist said, looking away. Bought it in the 4th.
Oh. Sorry.
Yeah, Whist said. Not like he was the only one.
Not by a long shot, Diz said grimly. How do you think I got promoted to lieutenant this young?
Usually it's for ability or courage.
Maybe that's how it is with the Marines, Diz said. With Reapers, it's for whoever lives the longest. Sort of a reverse consolation prize, he sighed. Actually, I kind of hope Boff didn't make it. The guy was a 3-time murderer, hell of a debt to society to have to pay off.
Yeah, Whist said through suddenly stiff lips. For a minute there, he'd forgotten who he was talking to. I suppose that kind of background might come in handy when you're shooting at Zerg.
Not as much as you'd think, Diz said, turning to look over his shoulder at the Reaper exercise still going on in the distance. That's why they're trying to bring in a whole new crop of kinder and gentler. Damn.
What?
Whist asked, focusing on the floating lights. Nothing seemed different.
They're greening, Diz bit out. Damn stupid. You got your comm?
Yeah,
Whist said, popping it off his belt and holding it out.
You want Reaper Sergeant Stilson Blomquist, Diz said, making no move to take the device. When he comes on, tell him his 2 southern flankers are greening.
Okay,
Whist said, punching for the base comm nexus and wondering what the hell greening was. The computer responded and he fed in Blomquist's name.
Shouldn't you be the one to tell
Sergeant Blomquist?
A terse voice snapped from the comm.
Who the hell is this?
Again, Whist started to offer Diz the comm. Again, Diz waved it away. I've been instructed to inform you that your two southern flankers are greening, Whist said.
Really? Bloomquist said. And you'd know this how?
Because I can see them, Whist growled. Just fix it, okay? He keyed off. What the hell is greening? He asked Diz.
Jealousy or envy? Diz said, still focused on the distant lights. In this case, a pair of hot doggers trying to outdo each other with fancy and stupid maneuvers. Oh, and here they come.
Whist felt his eyes widen. Here they come?
At least Bloomquist knows how to do a needle search, Diz commented. You told him you could see him, and he pinpointed you. So, not a complete incompetent.
Good to know, Whist ground out. The lights were definitely on the move now, and definitely moving in their direction. Should we, make ourselves scarce?
Well, I should, Diz said, brushing past Whist. Oh, and I'll take this, he added, plucking the bottle deftly from Whist's hand. Very deftly, in fact. Did that imply the man had been a pickpocket? Don't worry, you'll be fine, Diz added over his shoulder as he strode swiftly toward the door. Just tell him he can't talk to you that way.
Whist stared at the kid's back as he reached the door, his muscles tensed in fight-or-flight knots. Whatever was going on here, it had zero to do with him. The smart move would be to follow Diz into the building, return to his bunk, and forget all this had happened. But, for the second time that evening, he suddenly decided he didn't give a damn. He'd done nothing wrong, for a change, and there was no way in the world he was going to run. And sidearm or no sidearm, if a bunch of wannabe reapers felt like making trouble, he would show them the marine definition of the word. 10 seconds later, they arrived. Their technique was a little chaotic, he noted, as they dropped out of the sky around him. Their timing was off, and a good half of them couldn't even stick their landings. But the encirclement itself was competent enough, and a lot of the sloppiness was probably just basic inexperience. There was only one of the group who showed as even halfway competent. Whist made sure he was facing that one when he pounded onto the roof. Sergeant Bloomquist, he greeted the Reaper. Nice night for a flight.
Can it, feckhead?
Bloomquist spat, taking a long stride forward. Evidently, he expected Whist to fall back as he approached. Whist didn't, forcing Bloomquist to come to a hasty, awkward, and, to Whist at least, rather comical stop, which did nothing to help the other's mood.
I want your name, rank, and what the hell you're doing up here, Bloomquist snarled as he regained his balance. After that, you can report to the brig downstairs while I work up the charges against you.
Whist blinked.
Charges?
Since when is standing on a roof a chargeable offense?
When it interferes with a night exercise, Bloomquist said. Since when does a stupid jarbrain have any idea what reapers do anyway?
I've seen plenty of competent reapers. Whist waved a hand at the ring of trainees around him. These aren't them. He cocked his head. And then there was the greening. Bloomquist's eyes narrowed.
Who the bloody hell are you to call down my squad?
He demanded, taking another step forward. And, in the lower edge of his vision, Whist saw the Reaper's hands ball into fists. Deliberately, Whist kept his own hands loose. At 10-1 odds, the last thing he could afford was to let Bloomquist goad him into throwing the first punch, or even looking like he was about to do so. The problem was that with these odds, not taking out one or two of them right at the start pretty much guaranteed he would quickly be on the wrong end of a dogpile. But he had no choice. He hadn't given Bloomquist his name, but Reaper heads-up goggles had a record feature, and all 10 of them undoubtedly had his face by now. Even if Whist won the brawl, the entire marine food chain would quickly make its own dogpile. The only way he was going to get out of here was to let Bloomquist attack first and hope he could survive until the squad got tired of beating on him.
Tin hut!
Bloomquist spun around toward the rooftop door, stumbling a little as the weight of his jump pack threw his balance off.
Striding toward them was Diz, a dark expression on his face, a set of lieutenant's bars glittering on his collar. Bars, Wist noted, that hadn't been there before.
Lieutenant Halkman, 122nd Reapers, Diz announced tersely. What the hell's going on here, Sergeant?
Bloomquist floundered for a second. This man interfered in our exercise, sir, he managed, gesturing back to Wist. He also refused to give his name.
He interfered, Diz cut in. He interfered from here?
He calmed while I was trying to run a drill, Bloomquist said, argued about my technique, distracted me while...
If all it takes is a calm call to distract you, Sergeant, you have no business in the field, Diz again cut in. Was his criticism valid?
Bloomquist glanced sideways towards one of his troops.
It might have been, sir, yes.
Then take it, act on it, and resolve it, Diz said. And get your butts back in the air, now.
Bloomquist stiffened to attention.
Yes, sir. Squad, return to training locus. By numbers. Execute.
In pairs, the trainees lifted off from the roof and headed back toward the patch of sky they'd been working earlier. Bloomquist was the last to leave, still at attention as he lifted.
Well, that was a lot of nothing,
Wist commented as they watched the trainees drive away into the night.
Don't you believe it, Diz said grimly. Once he realized he didn't have a leg to stand on, his only way to get out without looking foolish was to goad you into attacking him.
Yeah, I got that, Wist said. Thanks for coming back, by the way.
Oh, that was always the plan, Diz assured him. I know Bloomquist. I just wanted to wait until he dug himself in too deep to get out before cutting him off at the knees.
To make him look foolish?
To make him look incompetent, Diz said, an edge of bitterness in his voice. I saw way too many good men and women die because of sergeants and lieutenants who charged in without thinking or observing. If we're lucky, idiots like Bloomquist will have been put on desk duty by the time the next war starts.
If there is one.
There will be, Diz said tiredly. There always is. He nodded back behind him. I left your bottle inside the door. I gather you were going to drink to Grounder?
To him and everyone else, Wist said. In all the excitement, he'd almost forgotten about the bottle.
Let's go get it, Diz said, gesturing toward the door. And then head down to the officers' club. It's warmer and they've got some nice couches. Perfect place to tie one on.
I thought all the clubs were closed.
Do I look like I care?
Not really, Wist admitted.
So did expertise at getting past locks mean Diz had been a robbery or breaking and entering specialist?
I'm game if you are.
Good. Diz grinned. And who knows? You're obviously wondering what I did that landed me in the Reapers. Get me drunk enough? Maybe I'll tell you.
Well then, let's get started, Wist said, inclining his head. After you, sir.
Chapter 2. The war was over. It was time to move on, provided Tanya Caulfield knew she was willing to pay the price. Lying awake in the darkness, she had to smile. The price. Those were usually words connected to warfare, not peacetime. Or so she'd always assumed. But then, peacetime wasn't a phenomenon Tanya was really familiar with. What with the Guild Wars, the rebellion against the Confederacy, the establishment of the Dominion, and the Zerg and Amon invasions. Most of her life had been spent against the backdrop of conflict and death. Maybe now the peoples of the Kaprulu sector finally had a chance. But in the meantime...
Tanya Caulfield, are you troubled?
She twitched at the sudden voice in her head. It was Ulavu, of course. The tone of a Protoss mental contact was highly distinctive. Besides... Even if one of the other telepaths in their wing had sensed her wakefulness, none would have cared enough to check on her. I'm fine, Ulavu, she thought back. There was a short silence, and Tanya could sense him touching the other ghosts' minds in their temporary August grad quarters, probably reassuring himself that he wasn't alone. Ulavu didn't like being alone.
Is there any way in which I can assist you?
There's no need for assistance, Tanya assured him again.
I'm fine.
I accept your declaration, he thought back. But there is an unusual tone to your thoughts tonight. That was why I was concerned. Tanya shook her head, taking care that the thought and accompanying emotion didn't make it to the surface where Ulavu could read them. Even two floors away, he was attuned enough to her that he could usually distinguish among her moods.
There's nothing to be concerned about. Go back to sleep, and I'll see you in the morning.
Very well. Sleep deeply, my friend. The contact faded, and Tanya sensed the subtle change as Ulavu's mind returned to its alien thought pattern. But even though he'd withdrawn from all the Terrans surrounding him, she could still feel his continued light touch against her mind, rather like a cat nestling up beside its owner, she'd often thought. Another thought and image she'd been very careful to keep locked away in a private section of her mind. Ulavu was as friendly and cooperative as any Protoss she'd ever met, but 2.25 meters of proud, noble, and telepathic alien was not someone you wanted to let think he was being laughed at. Especially a Protoss who'd grown as close to Tanya as Ulavu had. Therein, of course, was the rub. And the price. Because when she left, he would have only the others, and none of them cared about him nearly as much as she did. Carefully, she closed off her thought line against the cozy touch of Ulavu's mind and ran the memory of the letter she'd received late that afternoon.
From Commandant, Ghost Academy. 2, Agent X39562B. Regarding petition to resign from Ghost Program. As of 1500 hours today, your petition has been approved by Dominion Military Command. Your resignation will be formally accepted 10 days from this date at 1300 hours in the office of Colonel Davis Hartwell. Your service to the Dominion has been greatly appreciated and will be sorely missed. Should you wish to rescind your resignation, you may do so at Colonel Hartwell's office any time before that date. Best wishes for your future success, Commandant Barris Schmidt.
And that was it. One short letter. 10 more days of sitting on her hands while the bureaucrats loaded the Dominion's computers with a little more useless data work, and her life would change forever. It was time. Past time, really. In her 20 years with the Ghost Program, despite the wording of Schmidt's obvious form letter, she'd never done a lick of service for either the program or the Dominion in general. In fact, she hadn't been deployed in so much as a single operation. She'd never been completely sure how she felt about that. On the one hand, she certainly understood the logic behind it. She wasn't particularly powerful. Her Psi index was a fairly lackluster 5.1. But her gift was incredibly rare. Rare enough, or so she'd been told, that it made up for her barely there telepathic ability and her complete lack of enhanced strength and stealth that were usually part of the Ghost package. It only made sense to wait to spring her on the Zerg at the most opportune moment. Except that the moment had never come. When the Queen of Blades and her Zerg swarm began carving a deadly swath across both Terran and Protoss planets, Tanya was pulled out of the Ghost headquarters on Ursa and sent to a remote location. Then had come Amon and his attack, and still, Tanya had remained in hiding. She didn't know why she hadn't been used in one or the other of those desperate situations. Her only guess was that she'd simply been forgotten, or else had fallen through the bureaucratic cracks. At any rate, when the dust finally settled, she'd been brought back with the understanding that when the next invasion came, she would be deployed against it. Only, that invasion hadn't happened. There were a lot of rumors about the ultimate fates of both the Queen of Blades and Amon, but there were supposedly only a small number of people who knew the truth, and they weren't talking. So on the one hand, Tanya felt like she'd been wasted. On the other, given how many ghosts had been killed on the war's countless battlefields, She had to admit there was a quiet relief that she'd been kept out of it. But her safety had come at a price. Every mission she hadn't been sent on was a mission someone else had had to take. How many men and women, she wondered, had died in her place? She felt a small stirring in the presence that was Alavu. He'd probably noticed the shifting of her thoughts and was having his doubts as to whether she was really as okay as she'd claimed. A stray thought came on top of the presence, a sort of distant voice.
What the hell are you doing here?
Tanya stiffened, her drifting mind snapping to full wakefulness. Alavu wasn't in his room at all. He was running loose on the streets of Kor Hall. And from the tone of the voice that had been filtered through the Protoss's mind, it sounded like he'd wandered someplace where he was very much not wanted. Ulavu, where are you? She thought at him as she grabbed her clothes, straining to pull something, anything, from his mind. But her telepathic power was too weak. He must have taken his psionic booster with him for his thoughts to be this clear. Unfortunately, the presence of a psionic booster meant he could be halfway around the planet. Ulavu, tell me where you are. It is an establishment for partaking of food and drink, the answer came. In the background of his connection, she had the sense of more voices, and their tone was growing steadily angrier. Where's your guard? Are they there? I wished to be alone tonight, he thought back. I left without them. Tanya mouthed a curse. So he'd somehow slipped his military escort, the people who were supposed to keep this exact thing from happening? Terrific. Did you see a sign in the window when you went in? She asked, sealing her jumpsuit and scooping up her boots. Belatedly, she wondered if her ghost uniform might have been a better choice, air of authority and all that. But time was of the essence, and it was too late to change now. Or above the door? There is a sign. The image on it is three concentric circles. Are there any words? Yes, two. Dante's circle. Tanya made a face. The good news was that at least he was still in August grad. The bad news was that Dante's circle was a low-rent tavern run by and catering to men and women who'd had relatives and friends on Chao Sara when the planet was incinerated by the Protoss. In other words, it was about the last place on Kor Hall where a Protoss would be welcome. Damn it all. She and others had warned Commandant Schmidt that moving the Academy here from their usual base on Ursa, even temporarily, was a bad idea. Up there, they had Alavu contained and controlled. Here, one simple backdoor sneak out, and he had a whole planet to wander around. And unless she did something fast, there was likely to be a very serious incident. Ulavu, you need to get out of there right now, she said, hopping awkwardly down the corridor on her right foot as she pulled on her left boot. Can you do that?
That would not be polite. I believe the owners and guests wish me to stay. Some have indicated they want to speak further with me.
I'll just bet they have. Tanya bit out, running quickly through her options. The obvious one was to alert the guards who were supposed to be riding herd on him, but under the circumstances she wasn't feeling wildly confident of their abilities. She could try the police instead, but their response time wasn't great this late at night, and most of them wouldn't have the slightest idea what to do with a wayward Protoss anyway, ditto for the regular MPs. Besides, no one on Kor Hall knew Ulavu as well as Tanya. The only way this would end well would be for her to do it herself. Dante's circle was a good click and a half away from their temporary barracks. Luckily, Jeff Christopher always left his hoverbike parked at the side door, and she'd long since sussed out the starter code. 2 minutes and about 20 broken traffic regs later, she was there. She'd never seen the inside of Dante's, but from its rep, she'd always imagined it would be dark and gloomy, with a pervading vibe of anger and resentment and brooding. She'd also expected that the clientele would be a match for the decor, with big, angry men drinking to numb the distant pain of their loss. She was right on all counts. The only thing she'd missed was the haze of drifting smoke from the open grill. In fact, the thought struck her as she eased her way through the crowd, Dante's might very well be someone's reconstruction of what it would be like to sit in a bar on an incinerated planet. A deliberate attempt to play to the customer's pain? Possibly. It probably didn't hurt the drink sales either. She'd half expected to find Olavu in the middle of a full-bore melee. To her relief, he was standing calmly with his back to the bar, stiff and motionless, the top of his head just below the level of the exposed ceiling beams, faced by a triple semicircle of muttering men. Muttering, but also motionless. Tanya couldn't blame them. A Protoss, even a calm, non-threatening one, was a hell of an intimidating sight. Tall and slender, his eyes glittering from his long, noseless and mouthless head, Olavu seemed to radiate the sheer presence and ancient dignity of his race. His hands, two-fingered with a pair of flanking opposable thumbs, could twist a Terran arm out of its socket or crush a Terran throat. His legs were bent slightly at the back-jointed knees, his large three-toed feet planted in a stable stance like small trees. He was wearing his usual outfit of a long civilian tunic and leg wrappings, the slender cylinder that was his psionic booster hanging from his waist sash. There was no threat there, nor even a hint of the fearsome warrior that most Terrans visualized when they thought of Protoss. But still, the mob hesitated. They might not like Protoss, but apparently no one was willing to throw the first punch against something that outweighed and outsized them by that much. Yet the stalemate might be about to come to an end. Standing just inside the inner circle, visible in glimpses as the crowd shuffled back and forth, was a man who might well be big enough to take down even a Protoss. And judging by the slurring of his curses, he was drunk enough to try. Ghosts often worked the battlefield alone, with little need for formal command training, but Tanya had picked up a few pointers along the way. Time to see if they worked. "All right, clear the way, clear the way," she called over the muttering and garbled curses, pitching her voice as deep as she could and biting out the words like a Marine sergeant she'd once met. "What the hell's going on here?" For a second, she thought it was actually going to work. The two outer rings magically peeled back as she strode toward them, opening a path toward the confrontation. But the inner ring was made up of men who were slower, were drunker, or had used those extra couple of moments of lead time to stifle the automatic obedience to authority that the late Emperor Arcturus Mengsk had worked so hard to instill in his subjects. Tanya had to physically shoulder her way through the last line, which cost her several seconds, a fair amount of effort, and whatever edge of authority she'd managed to build. Unfortunately, none of that erosion was lost on the big drunk. Even as she broke her way into the open area, he turned and gave her the hard-edged glare he'd just been giving Olavu.
"Who the hell are you?" he demanded. "His keeper?"
His lip twisted.
"His pet?"
"I'm just a friend," Tanya said, keeping her voice calm. Even with her limited teep ability, it was clear that she and Olavu were sitting on a powder keg. A single wrong word, a single wrong move, and the place could erupt. "I sympathize with your loss, I really do. But Olavu had nothing to do with Chausara. He's an academician, a researcher of—"
"How the hell you know what we lost?"
the big man demanded.
"You think just 'cause—"
He broke off, his red face going even redder.
"Ah, damn. You a ghost? You a bloody damn ghost?"
An unpleasant ripple went through the crowd, both verbal and mental, dark with fear and anger and resentment. The ghosts had been Emperor Arcturus's personal assassin corps, nearly mythic beings who hit their targets and then faded into the night. Tanya sighed, so much for keeping a low profile.
"Watch it, Rylan," someone in the crowd warned.
"Yeah, like hell I will,"
Rylan growled back.
"They don't walk around killing anymore. Emperor Val says so."
"Yeah, but she can still read your mind."
"She read my mind. She's gonna see a whole heap of ugly,"
Rylan retorted, his eyes still hard on Tanya.
You reading me, Curve?
It doesn't take a ghost to know you're all here because you're mourning Chausara, Tanya said, fighting against the red haze of anger that had suddenly formed across her eyes. Curve? Curve? How dare these idiot hardshells talk to her that way? How dare they blame her or Alavu for something that had happened over a decade ago, especially something neither of them had been involved with?
Like what do you care about Chausara? Rylan bit out. Your ugly pal burned it. He burned it.
The red haze in front of Tanya's eyes took on the appearance of tongues of fire. You want to see something burn? She thought viciously toward him. How about you? You want to see you burn? Because she could do it. She could set him on fire where he stood, turn him into a blazing torch of screaming stupid. They wanted to wallow in bitterness here in this useless retrograde bar? Fine. This idiot could be part of it. Show them what the destruction of Chausara had really been like. For that matter, why stop with him? There was a whole bunch of people here who had nothing to do but pick at the scabs of past memories. Maybe a little real danger and pain would snap them back to the real world. A world that the ghosts and the rest of the Dominion forces, and yes, the Protoss too, had fought and bled and died for to make everyone safer. Tanya Caulfield. Ulavu's voice came into her mind, flowing over her fury like cool water. Calmness. For some ghosts, Tanya knew a cautioning word from a friend or colleague was like throwing a cutoff switch. For her, it was never like that. But even with her self-control wavering, she could recognize Ulavu's logic. More than that, she was freshly aware that someone whose judgment she valued was watching. Taking a deep breath, she pressed a finger against the side of her head, a little bit of mental encouragement for the implant that was even now feverishly sifting out various brain chemicals from her bloodstream and rerouting neural flow patterns. And then, to her relief, the haze faded away. She had control back and could once again think straight. She looked around the crowd, no longer seeing them as potential targets for her power, but as simple, ordinary people. Time to put frustration aside and start thinking tactically. All right. Rylan was clearly the leader here. If she could talk him down, she should be able to defuse the situation. If she couldn't talk him down, she would have to break him. Tanya, Ulavu spoke again into her mind. I'm all right, she assured him. Trust me. Even those who didn't have loved ones on Chausara felt the shock and horror of that day, she said, a shiver running up her back.
Easy to say, Rylan said contemptuously.
Easy to feel, Tanya bit back. I've been there. I've seen the devastation, cities reduced to ash, mountains shattered, lakes and rivers vaporized and their beds broken and half-melted. Plains turned to glass. Even after all these years, the only life that started to come back are a few lichens and some bits of moss.
Yeah, I've seen it too, Rylan said, his voice low, his gaze lowered to the floor.
Then, abruptly, his eyes came up and his finger jabbed accusingly toward Ulavu.
And it was his people who did it.
Tanya sighed. So much for talking him down.
His people did, yes, she said, searching her peripheral vision for inspiration. The psionic booster hanging at Olavu's waist was heavy enough to throw, but delicate enough, and expensive enough, to be strictly a last-ditch weapon. There were no liquor bottles within easy reach, and even if there were, she didn't want to seriously harm anyone. At least, not anymore. On the bar beside Ulavu was a glass stein half full of beer. It wasn't much, but it would have to do. Slowly, casually, she drifted across the circle toward Ulavu and the stein.
But it was the Protoss leadership who made that decision, and other Protoss who carried it out. Ulavu wasn't part of either group. You're right. Their response to the Zerg infestation was absolutely inexcusable, but we've paid them back. she added, again sweeping her gaze around the crowd as she came to Olavu's side. Trust me, we've paid them back in full. She raised her hand toward Olavu in emphasis. And as I said, Olavu wasn't even there. You're surely not going to hurt an innocent Protoss for the crimes of his...
Innocent? Ryland cut in. Who the hell says any of the damn fish faces are innocent?
His hands, which had been opening and closing restlessly at his sides, abruptly bunched into fists. His center of mass leaned forward, one foot starting into a stride toward the hated alien standing in front of him. Tanya grabbed the stein and hurled the contents straight at Ryland's face. She had maybe a quarter second to make this work. But she'd already run the numbers and knew what she needed to do. The flashpoint of ethyl alcohol in this concentration should be around 50 degrees, while the temperature at which human flesh started to register first-degree burns was about 44. An uncomfortably narrow target zone, but she'd trained long and hard to fine-tune her pyrokinesis to that kind of precision. She flash-heated the beer in mid-flight, watched Ryland's eyes widen in disbelief as it splashed into his face. An instant later, the surprise turned to shock as the scalding liquid punched a face full of pain straight through his liquor-soaked nerves. He roared in agony, his bunched fists changing to flat palms slapped over his eyes, that first forward step collapsing into an off-balance stumble backward. Confused, disoriented, and hurting, Ryland, along with his big, bad, brave attack against the hated symbol of the whole Protoss race, had screeched to a halt. And everyone in Dantes knew it. In that same stunned pair of seconds, the mood of the crowd shifted as their chosen hero faltered. Tanya gave it another second to sink in. Then, she took Olavu's arm and again sent her gaze across the crowd, pausing to catch the eyes of the biggest men in sight. A couple of them held her gaze, but most of them quickly looked away. Ryland was clearly a bigger force here than even she had realized.
I don't think Ryland's up to a fight tonight, she said calmly. So we'll be leaving now.
She hesitated.
And please believe me that we're as sorry about Chausara as you are.
No one disputed the point. No one said anything at all. With Olavu in tow, she walked boldly toward the crowd. This time, all three rings opened for her without resistance. A minute later, they were out in the chilly night air.
There was no great need for you to come to my aid, Tanya Caulfield.
Ilavu's thought came as she steered him toward her borrowed hoverbike.
That Terran would not have caused me harm.
You sure about that? She countered sourly. Because it damn well looked like he was getting ready to cause you harm.
For a moment, Olavu seemed to ponder that, his thoughts swirling by too rapidly for Tanya to keep up with.
You used your gift in a public forum, he said at last. Will your superiors not be unhappy with you?
Tanya winced. Yes, they would definitely be unhappy. She was the Ghost Program's secret weapon, and they'd gone to incredible lengths to keep her power under wraps. They'd be well past unhappy, more into furious territory. But only if they knew.
I'm hoping they don't find out, she said. All anyone in the bar saw was me throwing beer into a man's face. They'll think his reaction was just from getting alcohol in his eyes.
There will be no burns.
Nothing obvious. I kept the heat below the flashpoint and it wasn't in contact long enough for any serious reddening. A little, maybe, but nothing too visible.
Again, Olavu pondered.
But the Terran himself will know.
The Terran himself was roaring drunk, Tanya reminded him. I'm guessing the memories will be so hazy that he won't remember exactly what stopped him.
You are guessing? Or you are hoping?
A little of both, Tanya conceded. She fixed him with a stern gaze. Let's talk about you now. What were you doing in there?
I am a researcher, he said, his mental tone going full-bore Protoss pride. I wished to see and understand the sense of those who had lost companions and family
to Protoss errors.
Tanya grimaced. Protoss errors? Did they still think of the destruction of an entire planet full of innocent Terrans as simply an error?
The anger was starting to flow again. Sternly, she forced it back. And do you understand?
He gave the mental equivalent of a sigh.
There remains much pain, much anger.
And none of us blames them a bit for that, Tanya said pointedly. So do not try something like that again, you hear me? Because the next time, I might just let them show you what Terran pain and anger look like.
There is no need for that, Ulavu said, a grim edge to his mental voice. As you said, we were paid back in full.
Tanya nodded silently. The war had indeed exacted a terrible toll on the Protoss. Many of them had fallen in battle. Their homeworld of ire had been devastated and abandoned. Their society had been ripped apart. Some of the factions eventually coming back together, others turning away from the rest of their people. And worst of all, the Kala, the mystic psionic connection that had bound the Protoss in thought and purpose for centuries, had been destroyed. Years after that cataclysm, they were still struggling with what it now meant to be Protoss. Was that desperate cultural struggle the reason Ulavu had been abandoned by his people? Was their attention so turned inward that they had no energy to spend in bringing him back and integrating him into their slowly redeveloping society? Or was it something darker? Had he done something specific that had turned them against him? Because sometimes making enemies was easy to do. Sometimes it was painfully easy to do. She closed her eyes briefly, the emotional scab momentarily peeling back. She hadn't meant to lose control that day 4 years ago. Hadn't meant to offend or anger the rest of the ghosts by ignoring their efforts to calm her down. It had been Ulavu who'd gotten through to her, who'd snapped the spiral of anger and chaos long enough for her implant to get the upper hand. The incident had resolved, and everyone had escaped unscathed, even the ghost who'd started it, who Tanya still believed richly deserved all the scathing anyone could give him. But the resolution had come at a cost. The failure of the other ghost to calm her had been bad enough, but the fact that an alien had succeeded had ultimately created a barrier of resentment that Tanya had never been able to penetrate or tear down. Ever since then, it had been her and Ulavu against the world. She still lived and worked among the ghosts, but she would never again truly be one of them. And very soon, they wouldn't have even that much of her.
She sat down on the hoverbike saddle, conscious of the frustration hovering just beyond the wall of self-control.
Hopefully, a stronger wall than had once been there. The big question now was what would happen to that self-control when she left the program. Under Emperor Arcturus, such a thing would have been unthinkable. Ghosts were ghosts, and they were in the program until they died. Period. But Emperor Valerian was a new kind of leader. He'd cut way back on the brain panning for Marines. Some said he'd stopped it entirely, but no one really believed that. And he'd also decided that ghosts who wanted to leave the program could do so. As far as Tanya knew, she was going to be the first to take advantage of that option, and it raised a whole new list of questions. Would they leave the implant in place? Surely they wouldn't just take it out. Maybe they would give her a new one, something designed to let her live as a civilian without turning irritating people into Roman candles everywhere she went. Surely they wouldn't take it out, would they?
Rylan still concerns me, Ulavu said, his tone going thoughtful.
I already told you not to worry about him, Tanya said.
I am not worried,
Ulavu assured her.
Merely curious. How did he know you were a ghost?
Tanya frowned. In the heat of the moment, the oddness of that identification had breezed right past her. But Ulavu was right. How had Rylan known? She hadn't identified herself, and she was wearing civilian clothing. No idea, she admitted. Maybe someone from the barracks hangs out at Dante's Circle and talks about a Protoss in the Ghost Program?
Perhaps, Ulavu said. That would not be a good thing, Tanya snorted.
You think?
I do, Ulavu said seriously, apparently missing the sarcasm in her tone. But since you speak of the barracks, should we not return there?
Abruptly, Tanya realized she was sitting on the hoverbike staring out at the city, while Ulavu waited patiently.
Absolutely, she agreed, gesturing to the passenger seat. Come on, I'll give you a ride. Try not to be conspicuous.
He drew himself up to his full height.
Try not to be conspicuous.
Tanya sighed. A conspicuous Protoss. An equally conspicuous pyrokinetic. Both of them rejected by their people. They really did deserve each other.
Okay, forget inconspicuous, she said. Just try not to fall off.
Chapter 3.
I understand the Dominion's concerns, Emperor Valerian.
Envoy Louise Dupre said, her pleasant alto voice in sharp contrast with the flinty look in her eyes.
But you must also understand ours. The Umojin Protectorate suffered greatly under your father's territorial ambitions. We are not really interested in giving you the foothold he was never able to extort from us.
Emperor Valerian Mengsk suppressed a sigh. He'd hoped that his 6 years of more enlightened rule would have at least diminished the long shadow of his father's brutal methods. Apparently it hadn't.
I understand your concerns as well, he told Dupre, keeping his own voice as calm as hers. The slightest hint of aggression or even mild irritation, and she would instantly label him as Arcturus Mengsk II, and any hope of putting a rapid response base in the Umoja system would be gone. But there was an even more pressing problem. Several Dominion planets had suffered massive destruction of their fields and croplands during the war and were still having trouble recovering. The sheer cost of transporting food and other necessities to those worlds was straining Valerian's resources to the limit, and another war could push the whole Dominion over the edge into famine. The Umojin Protectorate's advanced biotech could go a long way toward helping move them away from that line. Unfortunately, about the only thing the Dominion had to offer in exchange was protection from a resurgence of the Zerg, and the Protectorate wasn't interested.
Please be assured that my only intention is to guard the Protectorate and the Dominion's southern flank against attack. The last thing you want is an infestation taking root before we can get a counterstrike force in place.
I think we'd be able to handle an infestation without your help, Dupre said.
Really? Valerian asked. Because if you're counting on Protoss assistance, I strongly suggest you don't. Hierarch Artanis has enough trouble of his own without borrowing any from the Protectorate. Dupre smiled thinly, but something in her eyes told Valerian that this was exactly what she and the Protectorate were counting on.
And you know this from your vast experience with Protoss?
I know this from my ability to read the undercurrents of culture, society, and politics, Valerian said. It's painfully clear that they didn't come out of the war in any better shape than the rest of us did.
Perhaps, Dupre said. May I speak bluntly?
Valerian gestured to her.
Please.
The Zerg are a potential threat, she said. The Dominion is a definite threat. Perhaps not as great as when Arcturus Mengsk was emperor, she continued quickly before Valerian could respond. But whether or not you yourself have territorial ambitions, the fact remains that many in your government still want to see the Umojin Protectorate as part of the Dominion.
I don't know if I'd categorize it as many, Valerian said.
And rest assured that we're weeding them out of sensitive positions as quickly as we can find suitable replacements.
I'm glad to hear that, Dupre said.
When you've succeeded in that effort, and perhaps offered further proof of the Dominion's commitment to its current borders, we'll be happy to speak again.
A muted light glowed on the throne's small armrest status board. Scowling, Valerian looked at the display. He'd given strict instructions that this meeting wasn't to be interrupted for anything less than the end of the world. Single Leviathan, repeat, single Leviathan has entered the system, appears to be on course for Core Hall 4. Valerian felt a muscle in his cheek twitch. Leviathans were the Zerg transport of choice, massive spacefaring creatures that the swarm had infested and subsequently transformed into armored carriers capable of both interplanetary travel and ground-to-orbit flight. Their huge interior chambers could house tens of thousands of combat-ready Zerg. And despite the emphasized words and the brief alert, in Valerian's experience, Leviathans never traveled alone. Never. Dupre was still listing the conditions Valerian needed to meet before the Umojin Protectorate would be willing to sit down at the negotiating table.
"Excuse me, Envoy Dupre," Valerian interrupted. "A situation has arisen, and I must leave." He stood up, locking his eyes onto hers. "A Leviathan has just appeared in the Core Hall system, heading this way."
He had the minor satisfaction of watching her face go pale.
"The Zerg?"
"I don't know anyone else in the Kaprulu sector who uses Leviathans," he said. "I'll leave orders to have your ship prepped immediately. Assuming you wish to leave?"
"I do," she said, her words coming out mechanically.
"I don't blame you," Valerian raised his eyebrows. "And when you get back to Umoja, perhaps you and the ruling council will want to revise your threat assessments. The ones where the Zerg are only a potential threat?"
He was out of the throne room before she could come up with a reply. When Arcturus Minsk named himself Emperor of the newly declared Terran Dominion, he began working on a war room that he hoped would be impervious to any conceivable attack. Valerian wasn't sure he'd completely achieved that goal, but he had to admit, his father had taken a highly impressive run at it. The bunker, as it was universally called inside the palace, was 100 meters underground, surrounded by multiple layers of reinforced plascrete and lead supplemented by mu metal and superconducting meshes. Its air and water were filtered down to the molecular level. Its exterior was grounded against electromagnetic pulses and charged particle radiation, and it was a good 50 meters deeper than any Protoss planetary incineration anyone had ever seen. It had instant communications with the entire planet and every ship and orbiting station in the system. It was stocked with small arms weapons and loyal men and women who knew how to use them. And it had living quarters, food, and water for 100 people to wait out a 10-year siege. So why, Valerian thought as he passed through the final door, did he still feel as exposed as if he were strolling through the palace's rooftop garden? There were half a dozen men and women waiting in the Combat Information Center when Valerian arrived, the top people in Core Hall's planetary defense system, and the Dominion's war-making machine. 6 of the 9 comm displays that wrapped around the Emperor's chair connected him with other senior officers elsewhere in the system. The remaining 3 displays showed images of the incoming Leviathan. Valerian frowned as he seated himself. Common wisdom and experience said that Leviathans never traveled alone.
But if this one had friends, they were certainly taking their time about making an appearance.
"Admiral Horner," he called with proper respect and protocol towards Screen 1. "What's our situation?"
Admiral Matt Horner, who'd been half-turned to talk to someone else on the Hyperion's bridge, pivoted back to the comm camera.
"Emperor Valerian," he said, greeting the Emperor with equal formality. "Situation is puzzling. The Leviathan's been transmitting a message on 3 separate frequencies. The signal's a bit faint, but we've got a good scrub. Here it is."
He reached somewhere off-screen, and his face was replaced with that of a Zerg queen. All Zerg had a definite nightmare quality about them, with bodies that seemed composed mainly of bony plates, spikes,
and flesh-ripping claws. But Terran brains were adept at seeing patterns that perhaps weren't really there, and most people tended to look at Zerg in terms of familiar creatures, giant spiders, armored slugs, or huge bat-winged wasps. Queens were a special case, though. There, the almost universal reaction was that someone had taken a centaur out of old Earth legend, replaced the human torso with a section of centipede, and replaced the lower, equine part with a giant, nightmarishly armored crab. And with that image came the memories. All of them. The horrors of war. The animalistic excesses of the Zerg, the sometimes arrogant excesses of the Protoss, and the brutal, uncaring excesses of the Terrans themselves. All the death and destruction, all the pain and suffering flowing through Valerian's mind like a river of acid. The history books too often made it seem as if the suffering ended when the fighting stopped. Valerian knew better now. Between the slow, costly reconstruction of devastated planets and the lingering pain of lost friends and loved ones, the bitter aftermath went on for years after the guns and mechs fell silent.
The Terran Dominion was still a long way from digging itself out of the last war. If the Zerg now proposed to start a new one,
"I am Mukov," a deep voice rasped.
Someone in the room gave a startled mutter, and even Valerian felt his eyes narrow. Zerg queens typically couldn't communicate verbally. Had someone been playing with queen genetics again?
"I bring a greeting. I bring a message. I bring an urgent request. I am Mukov. I bring a greeting. I bring a message. I bring an urgent request."
The display cleared, and Matt was back.
"And that's it," he said. "It just keeps repeating."
"Transmit loop?"
"I don't think so," Matt said. "I've watched a few rounds, and there are slight changes in her face and stance. I think she's just sitting there, repeating the message and waiting for us to answer."
"Any idea how she's communicating with us?" Valerian asked.
"I'm not sure," Matt said. "The transmitter she's using is running the same protocols as the comm system from an old Valkyrie."
"Really?" Valerian said. The United Earth Directorate's foray into the Kruprulu sector years ago had not exactly gone according to their expectations. Between Kerrigan's Zerg swarm, the Protoss, and the Dominion itself, none of the UED's forces had survived to report back to the motherland. Most of their prized Valkyrie space frigates had been destroyed, but a fair number had fallen into Dominion hands.
"The Zerg have never used tech before."
"They may not be doing it now either," Matt said.
"It's the same protocols, but it's not a Valkyrie system. Best guess is they scavenged one, studied it, and then put together their own version, along with a Zerg psi to transmitter interface."
"Impressive," Valerian murmured. "Still, the Protoss had to be doing something similar with their own psionics in order to communicate with Terrans over Terran comm systems. No one had yet figured out how that worked. Odds were, they wouldn't crack this new Zerg system very quickly, either."
"But it gets better," Matt continued. "I had a couple of wraiths do a flyby, and nearly all of the Leviathan's surface chambers and passages are open to space."
Valerian frowned.
"They're open, as in there's nothing in those chambers."
"That's how it looks," Matt said.
"Though that doesn't take into account the interior spaces. There could be other Zerg lurking in there. Mukov has to be in one of those too, of course."
"Yes," Valerian said, eyeing the displays. "Leviathans were huge things, bigger even than Protoss motherships. But the outer chambers were the key to quick troop deployment. If they were all open to space, that would seem to indicate Mukov wasn't part of an attack, or at least not part of a quick attack."
"There could also be mutalisks in the open chambers," Valerian pointed out. "They should be able to take hard vacuum this long."
"Absolutely," Matt agreed.
Wraith sensors can't penetrate deep enough to see all the way inside.
Valerian pursed his lips. The whole thing could be a trick. But subtlety wasn't usually the Zerg's strong suit. Their preferred approach was to throw in huge numbers and survive or perish as the fates of battle decided.
I suppose we ought to see what she wants, he said.
We're ready to go, Matt said.
Good, Valerian squared his shoulders. Open transmission.
Transmission open.
This is Emperor Valerian Mengsk of the Terran Dominion, Valerian said, pitching his voice as regally as possible. He had no idea whether Mukov would even notice his tone, but it couldn't hurt. Tell me your urgent request.
The Zerg's verbal loop continued for a couple of words, then broke off.
The request is not mine, she said. The request is from Zagara, Overqueen of the Swarm.
Valerian frowned. Overqueen? That was a new one.
The Overqueen asks the aid of the Terran Dominion in protecting the planet Gist from the Protoss,
Mukov continued.
The Overqueen offers peace to both Protoss and Terrans. The Swarm desires only to be left alone. Will you help us? What is your answer?
One moment, Valerian said, trying hard to maintain his regal tone. The surprises were coming way too fast today.
Mute, please, Admiral.
There was a quiet tone from the board.
Muted,
Matt confirmed.
Your thoughts?
I wish I had some,
Matt admitted, looking more bemused than Valerian had ever seen him.
A Zerg asking us for help? And against the Protoss? Not exactly your everyday occurrence.
Agreed, Valerian said. The war had ended with a three-way ceasefire. And after Zagara forcibly laid claim to the systems around Char, leaving everyone else wondering as to her future intentions, Valerian had assumed she would try to keep as low a profile as possible. Something very serious must be going on for her to come to the Dominion for help.
Let's see if we can sift a little sense out of it, he suggested. Starting with this planet Gist, has anyone ever heard of it?
There was a short pause. Some of the men and women on the displays shook their heads. Others lowered their eyes as they focused on their respective computers or data pads.
Emperor Valerian?
The woman on screen 5 finally said. Valerian didn't recognize her, but she was wearing the collar flashes of a major in the Ghost program.
Our Protoss expert tells me that Gist was a planet they incinerated just after the cleansing of Chausara.
That's one word for it.
The barely audible voice came from somewhere in the group of officers in the bunker.
Comment?
Valerian asked, swiveling toward the officers. His eyes came to rest on Colonel Abram Cruikshank.
Colonel Cruikshank?
Cruikshank's lip twitched.
My apologies, Emperor Valerian, he said. I was merely wondering how reliable this data was.
I think a Protoss ought to know his own history, Valerian reminded him mildly.
Wait a minute, Matt put in, frowning. A Protoss? You mean a Lavu? I thought he'd gone.
No, he's still here, Valerian said firmly, putting an edge of warning in his voice. Matt at least got the message.
I see, he said. Okay, so Gist is a burnt-off planet. We know anything else?
One major continent constitutes about half the total landmass, the major said. Two smaller continents and islands make up the rest. 30-hour day. The main continent is equatorial, with two mountain ranges.
Yes, fine, Matt said, cutting her off. Do we have anything that would suggest why Zagara might set up shop there?
Nothing Ilavu knows about, the major said. Maybe she hoped everyone would assume the place was harmless and ignore it.
Possibly, Valerian said.
The more immediate question is why she needs or wants protection. He gestured.
Put me back on. Go ahead, sir.
Tell me about your problem with the Protoss, Valerian said to Mukov.
What are you doing on Gist that has them upset?
The Overqueen asks the aid of the Terran Dominion in protecting the planet Gist from the Protoss, Mukov said. The Overqueen offers peace to both Protoss and Terrans. The swarm desires only to be left alone. Will you help us? What is your answer?
Valerian frowned. That was the same thing she'd just said.
Admiral?
Not reading any transmission problems at this end, Matt said, his forehead wrinkled, his eyes flicking back and forth across his displays.
Try it again. We'll try adjusting the slip pattern a bit.
Valerian nodded.
What is Zagara doing on Gist that has the Protoss upset?
The Overqueen asks the aid of the Terran Dominion in protecting the planet Gist from the Protoss. The Overqueen offers peace to both Protoss and Terrans. The Swarm desires only to be left alone. Will you help us? What is your answer?
Terrific, Crookshank muttered. Zagara sent us a pan brain.
Valerian gestured, and the transmission went to mute.
Or deliberately sent someone with a limited response set so that we wouldn't waste time sitting around here discussing it, he said. Rather heightens the urgency of the message.
Or is designed to get us to jump without knowing how deep the water is, Matt warned. This could be a trick to drag us out into the middle of nowhere.
To what end? Valerian countered. We're certainly not going to leave the Dominion defenseless.
Or be defenseless ourselves, Crookshank put in. I assume you'll be sending a full battle force, Emperor Valerian.
Valerian studied Mukov's image, sitting motionless, alone, and supposedly helpless aboard an otherwise deserted Leviathan, waiting for the Dominion's answer to Zagara's plea. If this was a trick, it was well outside the Zerg norm. But Zagara had been an apprentice of the Queen of Blades, once known as Sarah Kerrigan, who'd been a powerful and highly skilled Terran ghost before she was infested by the Zerg. Could Kerrigan have taught her this kind of advanced subtlety? Or at least taught her the right words to get what she wanted? He signaled for transmission.
Mukov, this is Emperor Manxk, he said. Who leads the Protoss force that threatens you?
The Overqueen asks the aid of the Terran Dominion in protecting the planet Gist from the Protoss. The Overqueen offers peace to both Protoss and Terrans. The Swarm desires only to be left alone. Will you help us? What is your answer?
Mukov tilted her head as if thinking.
The Protoss force is led by Hierarch Artanis.
Matt whistled softly.
Artanis himself is leading the charge. Interesting. It is indeed, Valerian agreed. And with that, he realized there really was no decision to make.
He didn't trust the Zerg swarm. That went double for Zagara, who'd been Kerrigan's closest disciple and ally among the Zerg. Even at her best, Kerrigan had been something of a maverick. At her worst, she'd been a traitor. If Zagara was running a game here, it was likely to be a nasty one. But if following up on Mukov's invitation meant some quality time with Artanis, it would definitely be worth the risk. The Dominion was hurting. There were food and housing shortages, and untold numbers of permanently maimed and psychologically fractured veterans, and reconstructing the more seriously damaged worlds was putting heavy pressure on the rest. But in their own way, the Protoss were hurting just as badly. Their numbers had been devastated by the war. The Kala, that had once psionically bound them together as a race, had been shattered and lost, and at least one fringe Protoss faction had rejected Artanis's attempts to reunify their species and had headed off on its own. The Protoss had a long and honorable history, plus technology that was in many ways far superior to the Terran versions. On the other hand, the Dominion was no slouch in the tech department either, and Terrans furthermore had a long history of tenacious and creative problem-solving. Together, Valerian had no doubt, the Dominion and the Protoss could come up with solutions to their respective problems. But to do that, to even broach the subject, Valerian needed to at least make the offer to Artanis. And so far, Artanis had been too preoccupied to sit down for that sort of conversation. Maybe the space above Gist was where they would finally have the necessary time. And if Artanis wasn't there, it would prove that Kerrigan had taught Zagara how to manipulate Terrans in general
and Valerian in particular. He signaled again for a mute.
Admiral, how fast can the Hyperion be ready to travel?
2 hours, Matt said promptly.
He'd been a friend and ally of Valerian's far too long to have missed the signs that his emperor had come to a decision.
Maybe 3, depending on what size ground force you want.
We shouldn't need much of anything, Valerian said. Whatever we end up doing, we'll be doing it from orbit.
Forgive me, Emperor, but that's not a good idea, Cruikshank said.
He had his datapad out and was typing rapidly on it.
Unknown situations are notorious for not playing out the way everyone expects.
He's right, Matt seconded. Even if we don't get planetside, we'll want some marines and a few heavier units that can be deployed at onboard choke points in the event of an orbital attack and breach. Colonel, what can you pull together in 3 hours?
A couple of platoons of the 934th Marines are available on short notice, Cruikshank said. I can add in one of my Goliath squads and maybe a few warhounds. Reapers? Nothing but a couple of raw training groups in the area. But I've got a double handful of reserves I can call up. That's the minimum force size I'd recommend.
Very well, Valerian said. Preparing to defend against a breach seemed slightly paranoid. Still, Cruikshank had a point about unknown situations.
What kind of orbital force are we looking at?
The Hyperion is nearly ready, Matt reported. Phobos and Titan are an hour behind us. Fury, Circe, and Cerberus are 4.
Good, Valerian said.
We'll head out in 3 hours. Fury and the others can catch up. You'll need to ask Mukov for Gist's coordinates.
She already sent them, Matt said. Major Vitkauskas also sent me Olavu's numbers, and they match.
Good, Valerian said again.
Speaking of Olavu, tell Major Vitkauskas I want him prepped to join us. We might need someone on our side with a Protoss perspective on the swarm.
Matt's eyes widened, just noticeably.
I'm not sure that would be a good idea, he said,
lowering his voice as if there weren't already 50 other people listening in on the conversation.
If Hierarch Artanis is going to be there, it could be awkward.
It'll be all right, Valerian said firmly.
Whatever Ulavu's problems with the rest of the Protoss were, there was a mystery to unravel. Valerian had been a researcher himself long enough to know that vital information and insight could come from the most unexpected sources.
3 hours, ladies and gentlemen. Make them count.
3 hours later, with Mukov and her Leviathan leading the way, the Hyperion and its escort ships made the jump to the Gist system. The Protoss, as Mukov's message had hinted, were already there in force. 3 void rays, 2 carriers, a swarm of phoenixes, even a massive mothership. The Zerg had their own force in orbit as well, 6 more Leviathans. So far, though, the Leviathans were keeping their distance from the intruders, apparently content to watch and wait. The Protoss, likewise, seemed to be in an observation or possibly siege array, perhaps waiting for the Zerg to make the next move. And as for the planet itself?
Matt, Valerian murmured as he stood beside the Admiral on the Hyperion's bridge.
Didn't Ulavu say the Protoss incinerated this planet?
Over a decade ago, yes, Matt murmured back.
Completely?
I've never known the Protoss to go with half measures.
Valerian nodded, gazing at the huge bridge display. The display that currently showed the planet's major continent covered with a patchwork of prairies, broad scrubland, and lush green and purple forests, none of which could possibly exist. Valerian took a deep breath.
Okay, he said briskly. Get a signal to that mothership. Let's see if Hierarch Artanis is taking the Dominion's calls today. Maybe he can tell us what the hell is going on.